Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the arrest today in London of WikiLeaks co-founder Julian Assange, who was dragged out from the Ecuadorian embassy where he sought refuge and political asylum in 2012 to avoid extradition to Sweden over sexual assault charges that have since been dropped. Timothy Carr, the Senior Director for Strategy for Free Press, joins us to discuss the issues involved following the unsealed indictment from a U.S. federal court charging Assange with conspiracy to disclose classified information in helping Chelsea Manning break the password to the Department of Defense's computer network in 2010. Although Trump has praised Assange and WikiLeaks 141 times at 56 events in the last month of his presidential campaign, the president is now disavowing him. But while it is clear that Assange helped elect Trump, Free Press warns that, quote, prosecuting journalists, even unconventional ones, for publishing leaked material from government whistleblowers is wrong, dangerous, and unconstitutional. If this case goes forward, any reporter attempting to cover the most important stories of government wrongdoing, from corruption to war crimes, would fear extradition and prosecution. Then, with growing concerns that the Attorney General William Barr is acting as Trump's lawyer rather than the top law enforcement official acting on behalf of the people of the United States, the Deputy Attorney General Trump has nominated to replace Rod Rosenstein at DOJ, Jeffrey Rosen, may be even worse. Mike Zabrinsky, the chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, who served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice, where he also worked in the Civil Rights Division, joins us to discuss the alarming reluctance of Rosen to answer the simple question in his confirmation hearing of whether the landmark civil rights decision, Brown versus Board of Education, was correctly decided. Then finally, we will speak with Steve Howard, a sociologist whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world, who recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He joins us to discuss whether the removal of the dictator Omar al-Bashir by the defense minister after 30 years of brutal rule marks the beginning of democracy in Sudan or a transition from one dictatorship to another, or something worse if different elements in the security forces and militia turn their guns on each other. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Timothy Carr, the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Previously, he served as Executive Director of MediaChannel.org and as Vice President of Global Vision New Media. He's also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time Inc., the New York Times, and the Australian Consolidated Press. He critiques, analyzes, and reports on media and media policy for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, Media Citizen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Timothy Carr.
Happy to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks. And what do you make about the arrest of Julian Assange today? It was sort of expected, and I guess somehow the UK and possibly the US behind the scenes have leaned on the Ecuadorians for some time. But he was arraigned in court, and one of the things he gestured to the press as he was hauled off in a police van was, "I told you so," which I think is a reference to the fact that it looks as though there is an intention to try to extradite him to the United States. Is that your understanding?
Yes, and I believe the Obama administration had looked into this as well and decided not to move forward. We've known because there was a sealed indictment that involved Chelsea Manning. Chelsea Manning, of course, cooperated with Julian Assange in 2010, when many of these confidential government records were collected, and that she was she had refused to be a witness and was in solitary confinement for almost a month now, And so we knew something was up, obviously, and obviously Assange did as well. And we learned today, not only because they arrested him and dragged him out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, but they also unsealed the indictment and we could look at the charges.
And what are the charges saying?
Well, originally we thought that they were going to use the Espionage Act of 1917, which is a somewhat antiquated piece of legislation in the United States that they've used in more recent times to go after journalists and whistleblowers. But it looks like they're actually using another somewhat antiquated, in computer terms, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which was passed in 1984, which was designed to go after hackers. In either case, we're concerned that this is a press freedom issue because this relationship between Assange and Manning was one between a journalist and his source, and those are certain privileged communications that are occurring there that need to be respected. So we're monitoring this very closely. I'm certainly concerned for a number of reasons, but primarily concerned about the potential assault to press freedom.
Well, I can just read briefly from Free Press's statement here today. We don't agree with everything WikiLeaks or Julian Assange have ever done, but prosecuting journalists, even unconventional ones, for publishing leaked material from government whistleblowers is wrong, dangerous, and unconstitutional. If this case goes forward, any reporter attempting to cover the most important stories of government wrongdoing, from corruption to war crimes, would fear extradition and prosecution. So let's talk a bit about the case that the government will probably make that he's not a journalist. Do you expect that?
I don't really know what to expect. I think that any time the government tries to define who is and isn't a journalist, we get in very, very dangerous waters. So we're concerned that, you know, an effort to define what constitutes journalism by the government obviously raises some First Amendment concerns. But it also allows them to set a sort of precedence that would allow them not only to prosecute this case, but to potentially prosecute other cases where reporters are working with whistleblowers to bring forth confidential government information that may not be in the public interest. So when you do expose bad behavior or corruption, or war crimes by governments, that you should be immune from this sort of prosecution. So if they are successful in prosecuting Assange in this case, again, there's a potentially very dangerous precedent.
Well, we know that through the campaign, Donald Trump praised WikiLeaks for releasing damaging material on Hillary Clinton. But of course, today, when he was asked by journalists, he disavowed anything. He said, I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing. I know there is something to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happening with Assange, and that will be a determination, I imagine, mostly by the Attorney General. Can you make a case, not that it's necessarily something to be prosecuted on, but that having gotten so deeply involved in politics, Assange lost his journalistic shield, so as to speak?
I don't believe. I mean, we're concerned about what happened in 2010. Assange was working very closely with news outlets like the New York Times and the Guardian, who were a part of the disclosures from these findings. It exposed some really important information, for example, footage of U.S. troops in Iraq firing upon journalists. I think, you know, that was definitely, in my thinking, a journalistic enterprise. Now, Assange has done things since 2010 that may be questionable in the eyes of some. He's used some of the information that he's had in his possession for political purposes. Handing over emails from DNC officials to the press, to the Trump campaign, to be used in ways that are very questionable. But as far as this case is concerned, I think it addresses someone who was acting as a journalist at the time, and as a result, there should be First Amendment protections in play to make the case that Assange should not be prosecuted, certainly not for doing acts of journalism.
So the fact that in subsequent to the 2010 release of Chelsea Manning's material, which you certainly made the case that it was in the public interest, and they were among the people that were mowed down by that Apache helicopter, there were journalists there, and you recall the callous nature of the pilot, as though he was, you know, just sort of shooting ducks and enjoying himself. It was pretty grim stuff. But in the more recent era, and I don't know whether this is going to come up, I assume it will, but even if the case, the unsealed case that came out today, the indictment, to do with Chelsea Manning, NBC News has found that Trump had cited WikiLeaks 141 times at 56 events in the last months of his presidential campaign, saying, WikiLeaks, I love WikiLeaks. This WikiLeaks is like a treasure trove. I love reading those WikiLeaks. Could that be used in his defense in any way?
I think it could. I think, you know, in the process of discovery, in preparation for this case, should it go forward, that a lot of things are on the table, and there are a lot of unanswered questions about WikiLeaks' relationship with Russian hackers, WikiLeaks' relationship with the Trump administration. We know, for example, that Roger Stone was in regular communications with WikiLeaks, whether that was, you know, under the direction of the president or the Trump campaign, still remains an unanswered question. You know, that information may exist in the as-yet-to-be-read Mueller investigation brief, but there are a lot of unanswered questions. Julian Assange has been at the middle of a lot of these instances related to the Trump campaign, to Russian hackers, to the hacking of DNC emails during the 2016 elections. And so in the process of prosecuting this case, some of that information may resurface.
And again, I'm speaking with Timothy Carr, who's a Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Previously, he served as Executive Director of MediaChannel.org and as Vice President of Global Vision New Media. He's also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time Inc., The New York Times, and Australia's Consolidated Press. And he critiques, analyzes, and reports on media and media policy for The Huffington Post and on his personal blog, Media Citizen. So is it possible, though, and I sort of was pointing out the irony that the very administration that praised Assange in terms of Donald Trump is now saying it's in the hands of his Attorney General, William Barr. But what if through Roger Stone, and we don't even know that that case is going to proceed now because the new Deputy Attorney General appears to be, along with Barr, trying to sort of end the Mueller inquiry and its tangential and subsequent investigations that they've handed off to other jurisdictions like Southern District of New York. But assuming the Stone stuff goes forward, because there's an awful lot of material that was seized relatively recently, what say they develop a case that Assange was actually a Russian asset, which many people think he was, the server for WikiLeaks is in Russia, and there's no question that people are suspicious about what happened with the DNC hack and the GIU connection, and the timing was pretty extraordinary. The stuff was dumped on the eve of the Democratic Convention, and then when Trump was really in trouble towards the end of the campaign because of the Access Hollywood tape, where he exposed himself in the worst possible way as a misogynist. And he literally within half an hour of that, another trove of WikiLeaks stuff was dumped to take that story off the headlines. So could that case be made, and who would make that case?
I don't know how that case could be made other than by Assange's defense. Now, whether or not the prosecution, whether or not the courts allow that to go forward or to be relevant to this in any way is an open question. I'm not a lawyer, and it would be difficult for me to make that call, and I think it would be difficult for a lot of people to make that call. However, it is relevant, and that Trump is now trying to distance himself from a man, from an organization, that he was one of his talking points in the weeks in the run-up to the election is also something that should be looked into. I think it may be up to journalists to try to ferret out some of that information. And there is some question as to if this case is prosecuted, how much of the details will become public, and what judge will be hearing the case, and whether or not that judge will allow that information to be made public in any way. I think these are legitimate concerns, given that we have an attorney general who seems to be doing the bidding of the Trump administration and not necessarily allowing justice to run its course.
So it seems very strange to me that Assange seemed to go out of his way to irritate Ecuador's new president, Lenin Moreno. He threw his weight behind the Catalan independence movement, which forced Ecuador to distance itself from Assange. And then the embassy cut off his access to the internet. And then in February, he dumped a dossier exposing Moreno's that he corruptly profited from a deal with a Chinese firm. So, you know, and apparently he got into some kind of altercation with the Spanish guards at the embassy, who, my understanding is that they've been working with MI6, the guards, revealing contacts that Assange has had with Russian diplomats. So do you know anything about what's gone on? It seems in a way that if this is true, that it was a strange thing for Assange to do, to kind of irritate his hosts.
I don't think he's made a lot of particularly wise decisions. I mean, this is not a person who I would say has a great sense of judgment. I think that there are those who've suggested that he actually allowed himself to be tried in Sweden under these original charges of assault, that he would have, at worst, served his time and at least be free of that legal entanglement. But he chose instead to spend 6 years holed up in an embassy where, from reports, embassy staff and others there were increasingly hostile to his presence. There are a lot of mysteries around Julian Assange, and there you question the decisions that he has made in the past that have increasingly gotten him into hot water. So it's hard to say. I don't have any inside knowledge about politics of Ecuador or how that may have played out in any way here, but I'm often scratching my head on listening to some of the things that Assange says and watching some of the things that he does.
So the original case from Sweden, is that still in play, or is he in legal jeopardy in the UK and in jail as we speak, and he's already been arraigned in court? And actually the judge referred to him as a narcissist. I don't know what prompted that or what is going on there, but are the Brits acting on behalf of the Swedes, or do they have their own case against him for jumping bail?
It seems like they're acting on behalf of the U.S. The jumping of bail. And my understanding is that the Swedes stopped investigating this.
Yeah, that's my understanding
too. And that the British authorities are acting at the behest of U.S. authorities who have secured this indictment.
And this, again, this sealed indictment to do with the Chelsea Manning download of classified database from 2010, that was sealed under the Obama administration, is that right, with the Brits?
That's not my understanding. My understanding is that it's the Trump administration, the U.S. attorney from Virginia, that has pursued this more recently.
Right.
My understanding is that the Obama administration had looked into this and considered a prosecution under the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and decided against proceeding.
I see. So this indictment is a relatively recent one.
That's my understanding. And having read it just moments ago, the date that I saw was from this year. So
I see.
I don't know the legal history beyond that. I don't know if this is something that has been in the works for quite some time, that it predates the Trump administration or not. My understanding that this is a more recent effort to go after Assange by this administration.
So in terms of your work as an advocate for press freedom, Timothy Kaur, as Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press, what would you ask of the journalistic community? Because we've talked about the ambivalent feelings people have towards him, you know, people that don't like Donald Trump certainly don't like somebody that helped elect him. And
yes,
there's an awful lot of people that don't like Donald Trump, me included. So you're concerned, I take it, that that's going to color people's attitudes, and that if you, you know, want some sort of vengeance against Assange for helping Trump, you may be aiding and abetting a tremendous infringement upon journalistic freedom in the future.
Our concern is that, yes, I think a lot of people believe that Assange is a somewhat unsavory character and don't have a lot of sympathy for him in this instance. And for prosecutors, that might be a perfect scenario. They can go after a journalist who isn't in the public favor, win a conviction, and set a very dangerous legal precedent against press freedom, whether it's one that compromises the privileges that journalists have when they're talking to whistleblowers, whether it's one that lessens the importance of whistleblowers to democratic society. You know, all of these are potential problems that we have with this case. And so for us, it's really not about the character of Julian Assange, and it's not about the type of journalism that he does. It's that he is a journalist, and as such is afforded rights under the First Amendment.
But do you think that in this sealed indictment that came down from the Trump Justice Department, that may be the vehicle by which the Brits extradite Assange to the United States and he's put on trial, how does it relate to Chelsea Manning, who's been really treated very badly in incarceration? And I think Obama actually to step in, did he not?
She was pardoned by
pardon, Obama. Yeah, because he was really in a very frail state. But now he's back in jail, is he not?
Solitary confinement,
right.
Has been so for the last month, related to her refusal to cooperate in this case. And from the charges, the case revolves around her relationship to Assange, that they allege that Assange and Chelsea Manning were working together to try to hack into a Defense Department computer, which contained a lot of these communications and confidential documents related to the Iraq War.
So that means that however long this process takes in London, the extradition process, that Chelsea Manning is going to be rotting in solitary, right?
I don't know the legal fate of Chelsea Manning, whether or not having secured the arrest and presumably transferred Assange to the United States, whether that means that she will be let go or not. We're hopeful that she is. She has undergone, we think, cruel and unusual punishment due to her role in all of this.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Timothy Kaur, and I guess we should stay in touch. This story's sort of beginning rather than ending, I would suggest.
Yes, yeah.
So thanks again. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Timothy Kaur, who's the Senior Director of Strategy for Free Press. Previously, he served as Executive Director of MediaChannel.org and as Vice President of Global Vision New Media. And he has also worked extensively as an editor, reporter, and photojournalist for the Associated Press, Time Inc., the New York Times, and Australia's Consolidated Press. And he critiques and analyzes and reports on media and media policy for the Huffington Post and on his personal blog, Media Citizen. We're going to take a restation break and back look into concerns that as bad as William Barr is, Trump's nominee for Deputy Attorney General, Jeffrey Rosen, may be even worse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Mike Jablonski, who is a chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights. Between 2010 and 2017, he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice, where he assisted with the vetting, nomination, and confirmation of President Barack Obama's judicial nominees. Prior to that, he served as a senior counsel to Senator Dick Durbin on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and also worked in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Jablonski.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what did you make of the testimony yesterday by Jeffrey Rosen, who is being nominated by the Trump administration to replace the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein? And it was extraordinary that he could not literally take a position in questioning from Senator Richard Blumenthal about Brown versus the Board of Education. And he was asked whether that was correctly decided, and he refused to answer that. So what does that mean for the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department going forward? And my understanding is morale is pretty low there to begin with.
Yes, that's right. And it certainly is not a favorable omen. I mean, there were many, many concerns about Mr. Rosen heading into the hearing because the Deputy Attorney General oversees not only the civil rights work, but also the criminal work of the Justice Department. And Mr. Rosen has never served as a prosecutor and has no criminal law experience at all, even on the defense side, has never practiced criminal law in his career. So there were a lot of concerns about his background and suitability for this position, but that was really enhanced and reinforced by his inability, as he mentioned, to say whether he believes Brown v. Board of Education was correctly decided. I mean, this was a landmark decision, one of the most foundational decisions in our nation's history, and it's the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department that enforces Brown v. Board and the laws that were passed in the aftermath of Brown v. Board to help enforce it. The Civil Rights Division enforces those very laws, and the Civil Rights Division reports to the Deputy Attorney General. This is the number two position at the Justice Department and really is the one that oversees the work of the Justice Department on a day-to-day basis. The Attorney General is very important as well, but spends a lot of his time making speeches and being the public face of the department. And it's really the Deputy Attorney General who on a day-to-day basis oversees the work of that important department. And DOJ enforces our nation's civil rights laws, and it's very disturbing that you would have someone at the top of that chain of command who does not believe or was unwilling to acknowledge that Brown v. Board of Education was correctly decided.
Well, isn't it foundational in terms of civil rights law? I mean, it was pretty much the final nail in the coffin of Jim Crow.
That's absolutely right. And if you go to the Justice Department website for the section that enforces the education laws in our country, the very first words of the Justice Department's own website
are as follows. 60 years ago, in its landmark decision in Brown v. Board of Education, the Supreme Court held that the intentional segregation of students on the basis of race in public schools violates the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And then it goes on to talk about how the Justice Department enforces that court decision and a variety of statutes that were passed in the aftermath of Brown in order to desegregate our institutions of higher education and our elementary and secondary schools.
So in terms of vetting nominees, I don't know who vetted Rosen, but he comes out of the Department of Transportation, where his legacy there was that he tried to stop efforts to reduce pollution from tailpipes of automobiles and trucks. That's not a sterling resume, piece of a resume, is it, surely?
No, that's right. And there was a lot of there were a lot of questions about that record yesterday at his hearing, and so clearly senators on the Judiciary Committee were concerned about his record on those issues. And the Justice Department has a slightly different mission, but I think it shows that Mr. Rosen has a history of taking positions in both the Bush administration and the Trump administration that are at odds with many of the rights and protections that we hold dear and that our federal government is in charge of enforcing.
So how did they find this? I mean, he obviously was in the Department of Transportation, but how did he get from there to get nominated as a number two representative and upholder of the laws of the United States under William Barr, whose tenure is already very, very controversial? What is he somehow? Was he propelled by Leonard Leo? Is he a Federalist? Do you know how he got to where he is now, Rosen?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I mean, I think what we have seen is that there are about a few dozen very partisan, very ideological lawyers. The vast majority of them are white men, and they have served in the Bush administration, and now they're serving in the Trump administration, and they just are playing musical chairs. They go from job to job, and Jeffrey Rosen, he served in the Bush administration. He was nominated for a federal judgeship by President Bush in 2008 to serve as a judge on the very important district court in Washington, D.C. He was not confirmed for that position, and now here he is again in the Trump administration. He's probably too old for the Trump administration to nominate him for a judgeship, because they have really been looking at people in their 30s and, God forbid, in their early 40s to be federal judges. And so Mr. Rosen, I think, has aged out, in the Trump administration's opinion, to be a federal judge, but they're happy to put him in this position in federal executive branch agencies to do the bidding of this administration.
So is he on Leonard Leo's list?
Well, Leonard Leo's list is not public, other than for the Supreme Court. The list that President Trump made public was the list of people that Leonard Leo gave him, the people who would be acceptable for Trump to appoint to the Supreme Court. But there are no public lists of lower court judges or executive branch officials, but it certainly would be, I think it would probably be the case that Leonard Leo is involved in helping Mr. Rosen and many other of these administration officials get their jobs.
Well, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that somebody is feeding these nominees, and there's a whole list of them, and they're being pushed through very, very, very fast. And Mitch McConnell, the majority in the Senate, has changed the rules in order to cut down on the time of questioning from 30 hours down to 2, simply to ramrod these people through. So it's sort of like a production line. And my understanding is that Leonard Leo, who's pretty much the head of the Federal Society, is the one that's sort of driving this train.
Yeah, he is certainly one of the drivers, but Mitch McConnell is probably in the captain's chair there. There's certainly a lot of people on the right who want to steamroll and rubber stamp Trump's nominees. And as you say, this move from 30 hours to 2 hours that took place last week in the Senate, that is going to enable the Republican-led Senate to confirm people like Rosen very quickly, because 2 hours is obviously a lot shorter than 30 hours, and one of the most powerful tools that the minority party, in this case the Democrats, have or used to have is to deny cloture, which means to deny allowing someone to have an up or down vote. And 30 hours is a long time. It's, you know, almost two business days, and the Senate is only in session 3 or 4 business days a week. And so it really took a long time to confirm people with the 30 hours. But some people like Rosen probably don't deserve to be confirmed. And so that 30 hours was an important safeguard, but it no longer exists.
So what's your betting on this, on whether he'll go through? Is it a foregone conclusion?
Well, you never want to say that something's 100% going to happen, because you just never know what kind of information can turn up. But certainly what we have seen is that the Republican-led Senate has been willing to confirm just about anyone. Occasionally, one or two Republican senators will break off. Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska, she voted against Brett Kavanaugh. She was the only one last fall for the Supreme Court. But the Republicans have voted mostly in lockstep, and because they now have a bigger majority, 53-47 is their current majority. It's bigger than it was last year. They have more of an ability to confirm people. So, yeah, it seems very likely that Mr. Rosen will be confirmed probably by the end of May, if I had to make a prediction. But I do think there's going to be a lot of opposition to his nomination because of his background and his inability, refusal to say that Brown v. Board was correctly decided.
Well, does it give you any optimism that, I know it's for a different job, but Herman Cain, it looks as if his nomination to the Fed board by Donald Trump may not make it because Senators Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, Cory Gardner, and Kevin Cramer have all said they'd oppose Cain's appointment to the Fed. So are we to think that maybe the Republican senators are starting to show some more independence and less fealty towards Trump?
Well, it's certainly encouraging that those four senators have said publicly that they would not support Cain, and I saw news reports about that, because if you have four senators on the Republican side who say they're not going to vote for someone, well, then that takes you under the 50 votes, because 53 minus 4 gives you 49, and so that's a defeat right there. And so it is encouraging. It depends on who the nominee is, and Herman Cain had these very high-profile sex harassment and misconduct charges lodged against him, and that became very clear in 2012, and one of the reasons he lost the primary that year when he ran for president. And so if something like that came up about Jeffrey Rosen, I could very easily see his nomination going down. But short of some kind of scandal along those lines, it does seem that the Republicans in the Senate are voting in lockstep for the vast majority of Trump's nominees.
Well, just in closing, I wanted to mention that last night I moderated a forum at UCLA on the Mueller report with Malcolm Nance, who's a regular on MSNBC, who's written about Russia's involvement in the Trump election campaign, and Asha Rangappa at Yale. She's a former FBI counterintelligence agent, and Scott Horton, Columbia Law School, Harper's Magazine. And the consensus was there, amongst all three, was that they were all alarmed that what Barr is up to and how he appears to be protecting Trump at all cost. Now, of course, we'll know soon enough what comes out of these redactions and what kind of report will be made available. But one of the things that came up, and it relates to our earlier conversation about Leonard Leo, when I asked all three if they were so pessimistic that this was going to be bottled up and censored effectively, and that the public will not see this report won't see the light of day unless it gets leaked at some point in a kind of Daniel Ellsberg scenario. One of the questions I asked all three was, if that's the case, then what motivates Barr? Why is he doing it? And the best answer I got came from Scott Horton, who said Barr is a very close friend of Leonard Leo. He's a very, very much a Federalist, and that his motive may well be to keep Trump in power so that they can get all these judges through. Does that make any sense to you?
Well, I think, yeah, it makes some sense, but I think it's also important to look at Barr's track record. He has been in favor of a unitary executive and a very strong sort of an unchecked power by the president. He has been pushing that theory for decades, since the 1980s, when he was a Justice Department official, ultimately becoming the Attorney General. And so this is not a new theory for Barr, but it is very important for that report to get made public, because no one, not even a president, is above the law. And there was a vote, a unanimous bipartisan vote in the House of Representatives, just a few weeks ago, in which every single member of the House, and you know how conservative some of those House members are, there's some real extremists in the House on the right. They called for the Mueller report to be made public. And I don't think anyone contemplated a lot of redactions. It is just very important to upholding the rule of law that report come out.
Well, Mike Zabrinsky, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Zabrinsky, who's chief counsel at the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights between 2010 and 2017. He served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the United States Department of Justice, where he assisted with the vetting, nomination, and confirmation of President Barack Obama's judicial nominees. And prior to that, he served as a senior counsel to Senator Dick Durbin on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee and also worked in the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the removal of the dictator Omar al-Bashir by the defense minister of Sudan after 30 years of brutal rule marks the beginning of democracy in Sudan, or a transition from one dictatorship to another. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Steve Howard, who's a professor and associate director for graduate studies at the Ohio University School of Media Arts and Studies, a sociologist by training whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world. He recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He is the author of Sudan, Scenes from a Youthful Uprising, and his forthcoming book is We Are Mahmoud, On the Path of the Prophet in Unsettled Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Steve Howard.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And Steve, when you were recently in Sudan, Were the demonstrations taking place? Because obviously today the long-serving, I don't know whether you can say dictator served, but the long-ruling 30-year dictatorship of Omar Bashir is over. He's been removed by the military, but of course we don't know whether or not this is the beginning of democracy in Sudan or a transition from one dictatorship to another, or even possibly something worse.
Right, yeah. Yeah, when I was in Sudan in middle of December, early January, and yes, there were demonstrations going on then.
Well, in terms of the work you've been doing on women, particularly having been a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women in Sudan, of course, the iconic picture of the woman standing on the car. That's something, isn't it? I mean,
It's a beautiful picture, yes. Yeah.
So what role did women play in this, if you could call it a revolution? It certainly seems that way. At least one hopes it is.
I was really amazed, and I think it was a function of the incredible frustration on the part of all Sudan's people, and women bore the brunt of the oppression and the economic turmoil and the disruption of their family lives too. And I was just elated and so fascinated to see women coming out into the streets, participating in all night demonstrations and all day, or even very simply older women getting chairs and dragging chairs from their houses and sitting as close to the marchers and the demonstrators as possible just to participate in some way, even if they couldn't march along for whatever reason. Yeah, young women, old women, there were women of every description joining in this remarkable effort to oust 30 years of oppression in Sudan.
Well, the defense minister, Ahmed Awad Ibn Auf, who has basically declared himself the leader and the head of a transitional council that will lead the country for 2 years, not exactly a short transition. He's also, of course, told the demonstrators to stay at home, but thousands of protesters have vowed to stay in the streets in defiance of the curfew imposed by Ibn Auf. So how do you see that working out?
To work on Sudan, you have to be sort of an optimist, I guess. But in that, they've gone for 4 or 5 months now with these peaceful demonstrations that have only been met by violence from the government. I'm hopeful that maybe given all they've been through, that tonight will also be treated somewhat peacefully. I guess what I'm seeing on Twitter is that people are out despite the curfew. Yeah, it is. It's past 10 now in Khartoum, and they're so far, they're not being taken off the street. People, the demonstrators are not being taken off the streets.
Well, what do you think will happen with the fact that the 75-year-old dictator ruled for 30 years, Omar al-Bashir? He was indicted some time back in 2009 by the International Criminal Court for genocide. Do you think these new leaders will, even if they're from the same military clique, and it's pretty clear that the people in the streets don't see this as a transition to democracy, they're very leery of what's happening, but do you think that this military junta will deliver Bashir to the International Criminal Court?
My gut feeling, my initial reaction is that they won't. That was probably part of the deal that Bashir worked out. That they wouldn't turn him over to the ICC, and will probably spirit him out to Saudi Arabia. I wouldn't be surprised if that became his refuge.
It does feel a little bit like what's just happened in Algeria in terms of people power and people staying on the streets and sticking it out and getting rid of a dictator. In the case of Algeria, you know, somebody that had a stroke and was essentially controlled by the military junta behind the scenes, not dissimilar to Sudan. Can you make a case that there's another kind of Arab Spring in the works here?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always change coming out of Africa in one way or another. And what I see the Arab Spring itself as kind of following up on remarkable movements towards democratization that occurred further south in Africa, not just a spontaneous Arab sort of thing, but motivated and inspired by democratic changes in Nigeria, in South Africa, in Ghana, in Kenya, and all of which had some degree of democratic inspiration and moving towards more free elections as well. So, the region is a unity, but there's no homogeneity in terms of their political outcomes, and different circumstances are producing different results too. And I think comparing Sudan and Algeria is relevant because they're both happening right now. But the Algerians just tired of this sick old man, and whereas in Sudan, the Omar al-Bashir really was ruling with an iron fist and was seen in public frequently. He was appearing in villages and urban events and was regularly attending various soldiers' weddings and so forth. So he was very much out and about and clearly in charge. So this is quite a dramatic removal from office, and will be very, very fascinated to see what results from a post-Bashir Sudan. The place is a wreck, so there's an enormous amount of work to do, too.
Well, but recently, South Sudan was carved off from Sudan, making it the newest country in the world.
Yeah.
And right. Almost immediately thereafter, even though there was a lot of promise in South Sudan, these two warlords have gone at it ever since and destroyed that country, which is where most of the oil is, although the oil has to be piped through Sudan. So there's a relationship, obviously, there between the Chinese, who largely run the oil patch, and the governor of Sudan. And the only other, you mentioned Bashir may go to Saudi Arabia. The only other country that seems to support Bashir was Russia. What do you see in terms of the external players? Is there any chance that the hostilities between Sudan and southern Sudan will be eased, or will that continue? And what kind of arrangements do you think will be made over the oil?
Well, in fact, under Bashir himself, the hostilities were being stamped down to some extent, and Bashir had presided over a peace conference recently where several regional heads of state showed up in Khartoum to kind of validate some new peace arrangements in South Sudan. So he lately had been trying to be a more useful actor in the process of bringing peace to South Sudan, but of course Sudan had been such a evil perpetrator of the disaster that was South Sudan that, you know, I reluctantly supported South Sudan seeking independence. I thought it was a sorry breakup in that these two countries should have worked harder to stay together, and that's where their any kind of economic success could result from unity, not from being separate like this, but also with being met by nothing but hostility and violence from the north. There, it was a natural transition to seek independence, and however, that country wasn't ready to be an independent country, too. Just a few miles of paved road and not much infrastructure, and an economy that it consisted only of oil production, which even then was not completely ready to be produced. So it's a very messy region.
Well, of course, you know, Bashir's legacy, though, is that God knows how many women were kidnapped by Bashir soldiers and taken as sex slaves. But we know that more than 300,000 people were killed and 2 million were displaced, particularly in Darfur, which is why he's been indicted by the International Criminal Court. So he's got a lot to answer for.
Oh, my goodness, yes, definitely. He's a cruel and very cruel incompetence, really, with Sudan being a kleptocracy and just existing to enrich the military leaders who ran the place. And I really was impressed at how the Sudan Professionals Association managed to maintain peaceful demonstrations for 4 months, despite the fact that they were just being so terribly treated by their government. It was a terribly, terribly oppressive place.
Well, just in the last minute, there are, of course, there's the army and there are other paramilitary militias and presidential guards.
Yeah.
Is there any chance of any kind of intramilitary fighting as they juggle for power? Because these generals that are now in charge, led by the defense minister, are pretty much unsavory as well, as not much different from Bashir, right?
Right, yeah. Well, I think that there is the force that the Sudan government transformed from the Janjaweed in Darfur and turned them into border protection force, using money from the EU to prevent migrants from crossing the border and traveling up to the Mediterranean, to Europe and so forth. I think that they have been kind of paid off. So maybe this guy who's now in charge, Ibn Auf, is a terror in his own right and will probably rule in a transition with an iron fist. So I'm thinking that maybe there will be less inter-militia fighting in the days to come anyway. And but there will be enormous frustration on the streets, which could result in some kind of violence. I hope not.
Well, Steve Howard, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. Goodbye.
Goodbye. And again, I've been speaking with Steve Howard, who's a professor and associate director for graduate studies at the Ohio University School of Media Arts and Studies, a sociologist by training whose work focuses on social change in Africa and social movements in the Muslim world. He recently returned from Sudan, where he was a visiting professor at the Afad University for Women. He's the author of Sudan Scenes from a Youthful Uprising, and his forthcoming book is We Are Mahmoud, on the Path of the Prophet in Unsettled Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.